Sorry we're late, everybody.
Well, you told them in advance that we were going to be late.
I know, but we're still late, and I'm sorry.
This is Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema.
That is correct.
I'm Rachel Ray, and you are Rachel Roy.
Which one of us is Becky with the good hair?
Who thinks they know?
I'm just saying words. I don't even know what any of this means.
You haven't watched it yet.
No.
I've watched it twice. Okay. We'll be talking about it on LKTV, a podcast of the television.
Way to tease out the memberships.
Yeah. If you want to hear LKTV and two middle-aged gay white men talk about Beyonce.
Where we promise to use the word intersectionality at least once.
But never overstep our boundaries.
Oh, no.
Because I know we shouldn't.
No, absolutely.
That's $4 a month. What a great deal for you.
A steal, really.
Yeah, $4 a month. It's on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/linoleumknife. Yeah, that's what you get. You get other things if you spend more than $4 a month, but you'll see all that on the page. Yeah.
Did you say our names? Say our names.
I did. I'm okay. Rachel Ray.
Oh, right. Yes.
You're Rachel Roy. I put a chicken in the oven right now.
So that makes you Rachel Ray? So
that makes me Rachel Ray.
Fine, Dave White. And I'm Alonzo Duralde.
I poured some EVOO on it, too.
I thought that expression was banned in this house. Not when you're Rachel Ray.
In real life, it's banned. When I'm cosplaying as Rachel Ray, however.
It's too bad this is an audio show, because you're giving severe Rachel Ray realness, let me tell you.
Hey, everybody! So, where do okay, we'll talk? We are the Linoleum Knife, hosted by Dave White, me, and Alonzo Duralde, you, a podcast of the cinema, is brought to you by.
Once upon a time, there was a place called America. It was a swell place, a place where you knew the mailman's name, and fresh milk was delivered right to your front door.
That would be really cool if you could still have a milkman bring you milk in the morning.
I bet you could. I'm sure it's pricey as all get out, but.
Who in Los Angeles does this? Anybody? I think there's anybody who
does
this.
I don't know.
This?
We'd have to research that. We know somebody who has a milkman door.
I know. Our friend Chris bought a house in Long Beach that was built in the 30s. And his house has a milkman door. And I don't mean it's a big door with a hole in the bottom that the milkman puts milk through. I mean,
there's
there
a little
is
compartment.
A little tiny 10-inch tall door on the side of the house with a little shelf in it.
And little knobs where you can say cream.
Yeah. There's a little
Nothing
there's a
today.
Dial. There's a dial that was built into the little 10-inch door where you can point the pointer at whatever product you want the milkman to bring you. Eggs, cream, milk. Butter.
But we
insanity.
Digress.
And he actually had to paint it over just for security purposes of the house. Because I mean, like, not that you'd have to be able to shrink yourself down to inch high private eye to get in.
But it could happen.
But
raccoons could get in.
Yeah, it's such an incredible feature of this home.
Anyway. Fresh milk was delivered to your front door. And in this America, there was something called the teenager. The teenager knew all the latest dance moves to all the latest rock and roll hits. They'd line up at the counter of the local drugstore sipping malts and root beer floats. On weekends, they'd cruise the strip in their hot rods and maybe later go park up at Inspiration Point to neck with their best girl as the Platters crooned smooth doo-wop out of the AM radio. And on warm summer evenings, they'd pile as many as they could fit into their father's Buicks to catch the latest monster movie double feature at the drive-in. Giant leeches, atomic brains, okay. Crab people, yes. Killer shrews.
This copy has been going on for a while now, and we don't have a point.
I'm getting something.
All right.
America was innocent.
All right.
Kennedy had yet to be murdered before our collective eyes. Vietnam was a tiny place in Asia your geography teacher hadn't even heard of. Trump was nothing but a high card in bridge. I was a teenage were-skunk.
Okay.
Is a loving homage to these charming days of yore and the cheap movies the schlock producers of the era mm-hmm. were churning out.
Okay.
For one night only, step into the time capsule and revisit those simpler times when people were polite, families were strong, neighborhoods were communities, and you could see the zipper on the monster costume. I Was a Teenage Were-Skunk will be screening on Tuesday, May 3rd at the historic Vista Theater in Los Feliz. One show only. Visit www.teenageweareskunk, that's TeenageWere, skunk, like werewolf, but it's where skunk.
Yes.
TeenageWereskunk.com for details and ticket info.
Do we get in free?
We are on the list.
Oh, we actually are?
We are.
I was just kind of goofing.
Yeah. I have to teach that night.
Oh. Maybe I could go if I don't have a screening.
Yeah.
Of something that I have to actually, you know.
Some new work crap thing.
Right about.
Like we're going to tonight, for instance.
Oh, God. First Prince dies, and then this movie that we have to go see tonight. And I am equating the two. And I haven't even seen this movie yet. I just know.
Yeah. And actually, this actress and this director had a scene in a previous movie where she sings along to a Prince song.
Oh, you're right.
So it all comes together.
She sings Kiss.
Mm-hmm.
In Pretty Woman.
Right.
And now she...
has horrifying bangs.
Has crazy wig. That is the worst, saddest wig in that poster.
That is Dat Wig 2016.
What does he have on her? I mean, like, is this an Adam Sandler situation where he just is so great that she just loves him her whole life?
I suspect he's probably...
and doesn't mind that his movies are... puke and barf and throw up.
I bet, A, he's super nice. Like everybody says, he's just a super mensch.
All right.
I bet his sets are laid back and chill.
I bet they're fun, yeah.
And also...
I bet the food's really good.
Yeah, I bet you. So, yeah. And here's the thing also. His movies, while terrible, tend to make a lot of money.
Because people are stupid.
And so when you are an actor and, you know... you're being considered for roles, and they look to see what your last five movies grossed.
Right, right.
Even though you are one of 80 people who was the star of Valentine's Day,
That's
still on your list.
Okay, so Prince died.
Yep.
Prince died while you were... you left.
I was on an airplane, and the guy in the seat next to me was watching Fox News, and it was on the screen, and I was like, what?
I took you to the airport that morning. I drove you to LAX. And you flew off to Dallas for the USA Film Festival,
mm-hmm.
the film festival that you worked for back in the day and that you were still a visiting dignitary with four and two. And then I went to a movie, and 3 minutes before the movie started, a rotten, rotten movie, by the way,
mm-hmm.
that came with an NDA.
Yes.
So that I can't even tell. I can't even tell you what I went to see.
I know.
It's
eating me up.
Yeah. 3 minutes before this movie started, a person walked in and said, Prince died. And I was like, what? 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 And then, like, two other people around me were like, oh, yeah, I just found out, too. I didn't say anything. I didn't want to upset anybody.
And I'm like, what? What's happening?
Shouldn't we all go home now?
And within seconds, a couple of other film critics at this screening, who were seated nearby, thought this was a good moment to talk about what a terrible person Prince was.
And I was like, I will kill all of you, everyone in this theater.
Are you serious? What stories did they have? Did they have interviewed him or something?
I can't go into detail.
Oh, barf.
The rotten movie was already rotten enough.
Mm.
It would have been rotten if, you know, someone that I hated died. But the whole rest of the day, I just felt like I was in a daze. Celebrity deaths do not affect me. Never. Like, David Bowie was sad.
Right.
It made me sad when David Bowie died. Because I didn't know he was sick.
But here's the thing. Celebrity deaths don't affect you until you hit the lottery. The number comes up where eventually the celebrity that matters to you goes.
Brittany Murphy made me sad, but only because she was so young.
Mm-hmm.
And because I had the weird experience of having spent a day with her.
Mm-hmm.
Where I, in that day, learned what a lovely, charming, funny person she was. And so that made me sad. And I still feel that pang of sadness when I see her in a movie on TV or whatever. Kurt Cobain made me sad at that time because that felt like I was that age. How old was I? I was maybe a year older than he was.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that was someone of my own time. And then I had to explain it to everyone I worked with, because I was the youngest person
right
in my work environment at the time.
Jim Henson, I remember getting...
Jim Henson made me sad.
I cried when I heard the NPR obit. It was like, it really hit me.
I did not realize...
And I didn't think I was going to cry over David Bowie. And then I was listening, I was just digging up a bunch of YouTube videos, and I listened to Young Americans, and just out of nowhere.
Well, as you know, I'm made of concrete and ice and black tar. As we've discussed many times, and as you've learned over the past 20 years.
Indeed.
I'm not interested in having feelings.
Yes.
So the first day, I was like, I can't even think about this.
Mm.
This is not good. This is very bad, and it's very shocking, and it's not happening. In fact, I went to Wendy and Lisa's Twitter account.
Mm-hmm.
They have a shared Twitter account,
uh-huh,
which they never update,
mm-hmm,
but they updated it, and they basically said the same thing. We can't even think about this.
Yeah.
And I had to go see Snow White the Winter Soldier,
mm-hmm,
that night and talk about it on the radio at like live at 10 o'clock that night.
Right.
So Gary, neighbor Gary, went with me. We ate at the mall before we saw it in Burbank.
Mm-hmm.
We ate at the mall. When we were done eating, I said, we are not promised tomorrow. Let's have a Cinnabon.
You're such a philosopher.
So then the weird thing, I come home. And everybody on Facebook and Twitter is like telling their story and telling their story and trying to be meaningful. And I just like, I'm so sad. And I didn't quite realize how sad I would be, because if you'd asked me who's great, I would say, well, Prince is great.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
was it Margaret Cho who had the story about, do you like Prince music?
Well, all right. Someone met him somewhere.
Yeah.
And he asked her if they liked his music. And they said yes. And he goes,
Well, all right. Just perfect.
But suddenly, all of these, like, memories of working at the movie theater the summer we showed Purple Rain just mm-hmm. came back to me. And I was like, I guess I'm going to tell this story on Facebook. And I'm going to try to keep it short. It was like 8 or 10 paragraphs. So long for Facebook, but yeah. not real essay no. length. And I honestly thought it's going to hit the too long didn't read button. And everybody, and there's like 5 people are going to read it. And now like 400 people have read it. And
it's a fun piece.
I wanted to get that out. And I avoided watching all the tribute videos until I saw Bruce Springsteen singing Purple Rain, like the next night at one of his concerts. And I just cried.
Oh.
And I was like, I'm crying over the death of someone I don't even know.
Did you watch the Jennifer Hudson clip?
I did.
That's the one I saw that was like...
That was a lot of singing.
Yeah.
I didn't quite think about how, you know, it was just in your life, in the 80s,
yeah.
a Prince record comes out and you just went and bought it. Like, yeah. I was punk rock as F in the 80s and I just kept buying all the Prince albums.
Yeah.
Because everybody bought all the Prince albums and you listened to all the Prince albums because it was Prince and you listened to him.
And I remember, like, working at Tower in, you know, 1988 and
right.
people passing around the Black Album,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah, I had to go hunt down that Black Album.
Yeah.
Which apparently he disavowed later.
I think so, yeah.
That record's great.
I have a feeling that if we thought Tupac had, like, the post-mortem releases, I think there has got to be...
No, yes.
Archives of stuff at Paisley Park.
Think about that vault.
Yeah.
Think about that vault. And everything that he recorded in the 80s and early 90s that he listened to and said, no, and just threw it back. But it's still like monumentally better than everything else.
One of my favorite Prince.
It's hiding in
one
there.
Of my favorite yeah. Prince songs is is a song that he just tossed to a soundtrack.
The Good Love?
Yeah.
To the Bright Lights, Big City soundtrack album? Yes,
exactly.
Album. Yes, that's a great song.
It is a great song.
Yeah.
And I didn't have, like, a deep, heavy Prince story to share, but I mean, like everybody else, like, that was the music around you all the time. And,
yeah.
like, I remember when... It's funny, I remember getting 1999 and explaining to my sister what Little Red Corvette was about. She's older than I am.
How come she didn't know?
I don't know. But I had to talk her through it. I remember that I was very versed in the Purple Rain soundtrack well before I saw the movie.
Right.
Because then I had this flash of, oh yeah, I remember one of the things I was looking forward to in the movie was figuring out what the intro to Computer Blue was about, but they didn't right. tell you.
Yeah.
I remember when the Raspberry Beret video came out. I yeah. remember when the Bat Dance video came
right.
out. You know,
right.
He was just this presence all the time, and it was always going to be interesting and cool, and you know, Under the Cherry Moon was pretty terrible, but the Parade album is really great. You know,
yeah, that. I touch on it in the little story on Facebook, the hearing When Doves Cry over and over mm-hmm. and over again in the work
yeah.
while working at the theater, because that's the song that plays over the closing credits.
Yeah, whereas I remember having to listen to the closing theme of Where the Boys Are 84 over and over again.
Yeah. And how that particular summer, you know, I'm 19 and I'm maybe the worst summer of my entire life in terms of like, being unhappy, mm. you know, like not feeling like I was fitting in anywhere and anything.
Right.
And somehow that music was very comforting to me. That song in particular. And I would leave work and it would be on the radio driving.
Oh yeah.
And not once did I ever get tired of it. Because it felt comforting. And I didn't know how much of that I had internalized as a young person and what his music meant to me. Now, I don't know if there are listeners who feel like this, but there's a thing going around on queer social media about Prince being a homophobe.
Yeah, and he was. But only because he was a Jehovah's Witness, I think.
Later he was.
But I think before that, he is, as Touré said on MSNBC, he was intersectional before we had a word for it.
Correct,
you know?
Yes.
He totally played around with these concepts of gender and sexuality, even race, even though, like, unlike what we were led to believe by Purple Rain, he was not mixed race.
No.
Both of his parents were black.
Right, correct. Yes.
Yeah, you know, he is essential to queer culture, even if in his later days he was a jerk about gay people.
Right. It is a thing that he adopted later in his life.
Yeah.
In the later part of what amount of time he had. And when I heard about it, I thought, I don't want to know. And then I heard it again, and I thought, okay, this is real. Mm. So what do I do with this person?
Right.
This really cool person who has decided, because of his religious beliefs, that, you know, so much of what he helped usher in.
Right.
In that decade is now not cool.
Yeah.
Because I decided to do the Christian thing and forgive him.
Because just by being somebody who dealt so much with sexuality in the Reagan/AIDS era.
Yeah.
He was already essential.
Yeah.
And that he was doing it in that interestingly vague way of things that made him all the more interesting, you know.
Yeah. I so as I read the whole, you know, I'm not mourning this person's death because he hated gays. I you know what, if you go back and you look at the lyrics of his songs, they're all about, and I mean not always, but two of his recurring ideas, again and again and again, from the beginning until forever, were those ideas were the presence of God and the need to keep boning as much as possible. And you could feel that struggle in him, like they were irreconcilable.
Mm-hmm. The divine and the profane.
And apparently the Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, finally got him.
Yeah.
But, it's a part of him that he's dead now, so it's not like we can argue about it anymore. But,
right. It doesn't negate the work.
It negates nothing.
Yeah.
For me, personally. So,
I saw Under the Cherry Moon on opening night in Nashville.
Yes.
There were six of us in the theater.
That confuses me how you can go from this
giant hit,
decade-defining event.
Yeah.
To the next film where people are staying away.
Yeah, I mean, somehow, like, and this is pre-social media, but, like, just...
How did that happen?
It arrived in theaters DOA. Like, people already knew, no. I don't know if it was the black and white. I don't think so, because, I mean, MTV was adopting that for a lot of things.
Yes.
But, yeah, just somehow, like, word got out that this was going to be a disaster, and it was. I mean, it's a pretty terrible movie. Although, even then, I was like, this Kristen Scott Thomas gal is going places.
Right, that's her first film.
That was her first film, and I immediately made it a point to sort of remember her name, and, you know, within a few years, she was, you know, all over the place.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't see Graffiti Bridge. It kills me that Sign of the Times isn't more readily available.
Why isn't it?
Well, it was released by, like, Cineplex Odeon, this, you know, distributor that wasn't around much. And a lot of their stuff, I don't know who the hell owns it now. Like, they also released the Paul Newman-directed Glass... phone.
That's the alarm telling me that it's time to go.
Take chicken out of the oven?
Add an extra ingredient to the chicken for it to crisp up. So I would like for you to pause it for a moment.
Okay. Anyways, I was saying Cineplex Odeon also released the Paul Newman-directed Glass Menagerie with Joanne Woodward and Karen Allen, which is really good, and John Malkovich. And I don't know that that's readily available these days either, so...
Sign of the Times is incredible.
Yeah.
I saw it when it came out at one of the mall theaters in Dallas. But, yeah, I'm completely bummed about this. This just makes me so immensely sad.
Yeah.
So,
and we saw him when?
At the Forum.
Right.
In 2011. That was that great, we've talked about this before on the show, that great moment where he brought Halle Berry up on stage from the audience, and she stood there, and he gets the mic, and he goes, "Dance, Halle Berry." And she obeyed him.
Oh, hell yeah. And Susan Sarandon got on stage,
to dance, too, and he did not talk to her.
No.
She's not good at dancing.
No.
Halle Berry, really good dancer. Mm. When... commanded by Prince. Susan Sarandon is a mom dancer, and that's fine for all you mom dancers out there. But don't expect to impress Prince that way.
No. That was the same series of concerts where he kicked Kim Kardashian off
stage. We weren't there for the kicking Kim Kardashian off the stage. Although I think that was not nice of him.
I think Kim Kardashian needs to have somebody say no to her every so often.
She does. Believe me, the world is constantly telling her no.
Oh, I don't know that it is. I don't know that it's getting to her.
But it doesn't get to her. She just says, no, I don't hear you. I don't hear your
la,
no.
La, 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 la. But yeah, when Prince says it, you hear it. And then I never saw Graffiti Bridge, which I hear is really terrible.
No, I never saw Graffiti Bridge. But now I want to see all of them. You know, like, I want to watch all of them again.
Did you see Under the Cherry Moon when it came out?
Unlike when, say, Kirstie McCall died, and the sadness of that made me not want to listen to her sing for years, like years.
Yeah.
I didn't want to, other than at Christmas.
Sure. Fairy Tale of New York.
On the Pogues song, like, I didn't want to listen to those, songs. But I've listened to almost nothing except Prince all weekend long. Thanks to Gary Gotti's satellite radio in his truck. But yeah, like, I want to see, I'll watch Graffiti Bridge. I want to know what's in Graffiti Bridge that I ignored.
Well, so
did everyone else.
Read the Nathan Rabin, My Year of Flops article about it.
Oh, yeah. I know it's bad. Look, Purple Rain is not a good
movie. No, it's not. That's, you know...
But it is not a good movie, but it's a great movie. And that's a distinction that needs to always be recognized by people.
It's a great sort of movie to go with the album. But it's a terrible
movie. It's a great experience. And that's one of the things I wrote about in the Facebook post is how... The way people interacted with that film was like nothing I had ever seen.
Well, he very wisely ends the movie with like 10 minutes of performance.
And it begins with performance.
But you believe the theater on a high from that performance and you forget the movie that came before it. You know, the weird thing about that film for me is always that, you know, the whole movie is about... His character having to learn to not be such a jerk and to collaborate with others, which Prince never did. And B, that the whole movie...
So what? He didn't need to.
The whole movie is about how his style of music is so weird and how everybody else is, you know, they can't accept it and they make fun of him for it. And I'm like, you know, I'm sorry, when Morris Day is making fun of Let's Go Crazy, and Let's Go Crazy is the number one song in America, there's a disconnect here that the movie doesn't know how to bridge.
Well, I think that was sort of him... That was his story. That was his early story.
Sure, no, I get it.
Of people not knowing what to do with him.
Right.
You know. You don't go on tour with the Rolling Stones and get booed off the stage.
Yeah.
And all the while knowing that you're a genius and that they're idiots.
Right.
You know, that messes with your head.
Was this like
what,
controversy era Prince, or when was this?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Dirty Mind controversy. Oh, right. That part, that time. It was like 81, I think, when he was open for the Rolling Stones and the audience just
not having it.
Could not handle him. Yeah. Racism and homophobia. That is what that was.
Yeah.
That's what that was.
Yeah.
I mean, this was him coming out on stage in like a trench coat and underpants. Like, that man was incredible. So, we have to go back in time to last Monday.
Ah, yes.
Where we saw Absolute Beginners.
Yes.
A film that came out
in 1986.
2 years after Purple Rain.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of David Bowie.
And is a complete fiasco.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have loved this movie.
Yes, do your thing. Talk
about
it. For
a long time.
Yeah,
and
you have.
I mean, it was one of those movies that I remember being really excited about before it came out. And I was living in Nashville that summer, and I drove to Atlanta to see it. And, you know, and then I booked it and showed it at Vanderbilt. And I, you know, I got the import soundtrack because it had twice as much stuff on it. And I've always thought very fondly of that movie. And then it came out on DVD several years ago, and I saw it and remember, and I was thinking like, this is a bit of a mess. You know, it's
just a bit.
Yeah, like it doesn't hold together as well as I thought, but you know, there's still a lot of good stuff in it. And then watching it, this 35 print with you at the museum this week, I realized, oh, yeah, this movie's not good. Like, and here's the thing, and I think we talked about this when we did the Clue commentary. Sometimes if a movie has pieces that I like, performances and ideas and visuals and whatever, I will simultaneously watch a movie while re-editing it in my head into what it was supposed to be. But looking at it this time, one of the scenes that I remember being my favorite is where that fashion show sequence where Patsy Kensit, in the words of one critic, simultaneously invents the miniskirt and the frug.
Yeah.
And it's got this great Gil Evans instrumental and fun visual stuff going on. But watching that sequence now, like, A, the cinematography is really muddy and it never pops the way that it should.
It looks like brown soup.
It is edited completely bafflingly.
Incoherent.
Like, there's so many scenes in this movie where, despite the fact that it was famously over budget and incredibly expensive and, like, you know, sank at least one British production company, it is edited together like a crappy low budget movie where they didn't have the coverage and they didn't have, like, entirely the shots they needed, and they just sort of, like, would splice in moments from another scene or give you, like, a 2 second thing of somebody responding that's completely out of context, but they just needed, like, a character to get mad and turn around,
right,
even though it doesn't fit in the other stuff that's happening. Yeah, this movie is so bizarre.
A disaster.
I will still defend the music. You didn't like the music either.
No, I don't like the music either.
I think there's a lot of great songs in that film. I like a lot of the instrumental stuff. I like, have you ever
heard Sade?
I like the Sade song.
That's it. Sade.
I like the Ray Davies song.
She's never done anything wrong.
I like the Style Council song. There's a lot of, there's stuff in there, but it's, and I like what Anita Morris is doing and what David Bowie is doing. But they are at the mercy of this rando editing and choppy storytelling.
I love David Bowie, and I didn't like anything about him in there either, except for that.
That's motivation number.
Dancing on the typewriter, that's fun.
That is a number that actually is cohesive from start to finish.
Okay.
But yeah, that was, and so, you know, people will write the show occasionally, and one of the questions that we'll get is, you know, have you ever really, you know, have you changed your mind about a film over the years? And yeah, Absolute Beginners, I have been far too kind to for a long time, and I realize now, oh yeah, it's not very good.
I walked into that LACMA screening we saw at the LA County Museum of Art, thinking that I had somehow seen it, but not...
What are you doing?
I just got to the bottom of my coffee. Sorry. Your phone has gone off twice in this show, so shut up.
I walked in thinking, oh, he's shown me all of this already in chunks here and there. Like, that was my thinking going in. I've seen Absolute Beginners because you have never stopped talking about it for 2 decades. And I've heard the songs, and I thought, okay, those are just, the songs are whatever. But I know I've seen this because you've shown me bits and pieces, and clearly you must have shown me the whole thing by now, just out of order. No?
Nope.
Nope, that was not the case. You showed me your favorite bits.
Yeah.
And even they were not so great. I just thought, like, okay, maybe it all pulls together somehow watching the film. At about the 40-minute mark, I thought, my butt hurts.
You think that in most movies.
My butt is hurting me right now. And the film's not taking my mind off the way that my butt hurts. And then about an hour in, I thought, what's the running time of this? If you saw me, I eventually sort of leaned forward in my seat, sort of
extend your coccyx or
get into another position, stretch out my lower back. And absolute tedium, honestly, is what it was. It looked bad. It is horrifyingly edited.
Mm.
The acting is terrible. The songs are... It is a fiasco. I never, ever have to or want to look at that again.
I will probably still listen to the music, but I don't think I'll ever sit through the movie again, start to finish.
I did think it was cool that I could pick out Sandy Shaw.
And her cameo. Like,
look, Sandy Shaw.
Well, so there was that. You had some takeaway from the whole thing. So, hey, new movies.
You haven't seen any of them.
I saw two.
What'd you see?
I saw The Meddler.
Oh.
And Nina.
I won't watch Nina. I won't. Here's why.
There's no reason for you to see it.
I'm not going to because I still haven't sat myself down yet to watch What Happened to Miss Simone.
Right, me neither.
And having just watched Lemonade... And sort of, you know, bathing in black brilliance.
You are literally unable to can?
I am literally unable to can, yeah. I don't want to see something that is a completely troubled production made under bad circumstances and executed in a way that is only going to make me sad.
Yeah. It's a disaster. I mean... I will allow, I will step aside and let black film critics have the discussion about, you know, Zoe Saldana's skin and the makeup involved to make her look like Nina Simone. And there have been some interesting discussions about that online.
Right.
That you should go read.
That ain't my business.
Exactly. Not for me to talk about. I will say this, though. The makeup...
Yes.
...is terrible.
Oh.
Like, it's inconsistent from scene to scene... It's obviously makeup. Yeah. There's a scene where she's in the shower, and I thought, oh, God, it's going to start come streaming down in rivulets. You could play biopic bingo with the sort of cliches that it trots out. It mostly focuses on the least interesting period of her life. Like, the very end, basically, where she's,
How does Zoe Saldana play her when she's in her 70s?
With terrible makeup.
Oh, no. No, no, no.
And Zoe Saldana sings, and it's... Zoe Saldana does the singing.
What?
Uh-huh. And it's not that she's not... She's a perfectly capable singer.
Well, but...
But she does not sound like Nina Simone.
No, I
she's in a completely different register.
I can't... No.
She does not do any of the sort of vocal things that we come to associate with Nina Simone. It's
this absolutely distinctive voice.
Yes.
What were they thinking?
I cannot imagine.
I will never watch this film.
Yeah, it's embarrassing.
I like Zoe Saldana. I will never watch this movie.
I like Zoe Saldana and I like David Oyelowo, and they can do nothing with this material. And so much of the movie is about her relationship with this gay guy who was her manager late in her life.
Right.
And then there's these scenes with him and his family. I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't care about you. I'm here to find out about Nina Simone. And the whole movie about a diva and like her, you know, gay male / platonic compatriot, you know, has been done a million times and never very interestingly.
Is compatriot the right word?
Maybe not. Confidant, I guess.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, this is just...
That was the Meddler. This is this weird week where neither of us have seen the same films.
Right.
Has that ever happened?
I think it's come up before, yeah.
Has it come up before?
Yeah, where we didn't have anything in common, but we between us had covered a good amount of ground. The Meddler... I seem to like a lot less than many critics.
Are
enjoying it? I don't know quite what to make of it because
tell people what it's about.
All right, Susan Sarandon plays a widow, who has
chicken's about to come out. So keep talking.
Okay,
about it.
She's a widow.
If you need to, you can pause while I.
She has moved to Los Angeles from New York, New Jersey, one of those. To be closer to her daughter, who's a writer, played by Rose Byrne.
Only child?
Only child.
Okay.
And she, constantly calling, texting, dropping in unannounced, using her key, you know, and just being a meddler. And the daughter just gets increasingly fed up with her and manages to, like, keep her at arm's length, even at some point, like, going off to New York herself because they're filming a pilot that she wrote. So because the Susan Sarandon character is clearly not dealing with, you know, her grief over the loss of her husband, she basically starts expending her meddling energy in other directions. This friend of her daughter's who she meets at a baby shower is a lesbian who never got to have like a big wedding.
Right.
And so impulsively, she basically not only helps plan it, but pays for the whole thing.
What?
Yeah. And then there's this kid at the Genius Bar at the Grove. This movie, there's a lot of Grove in this movie. Like, they love the Grove, and they keep talking about how great the Grove is. The kid at the Genius Bar keeps helping her with all of her many Apple products, and so, you know, she...
How many Apple products does she have?
I don't know, but she talks about them constantly, and so...
Is that a plot point?
She's on the iPhone, and she's buying people iPads and stuff, and anyway, so the kid at the Genius
Bar... How much money does she have?
Seemingly a limitless pool, because, you know, the kid at the Genius Store, somebody wanted to go back to school, and so she, to help out, offers to drive him, like, once or twice a week or something.
Does she pay for it?
No, but she's driving him. And it's like... And you're thinking, okay, so this is a woman, you know, who's
maybe she just likes to help people.
Well, that's the thing.
You know how good I am at helping you all the time.
You're a meddler. you call a movie The Meddler, and you think, okay, that she's gonna give this sort of unwelcome advice, or she's just acting out because she's not dealing with her own stuff, and that eventually she's gonna have this meltdown, and then she's not gonna deliver on what she's promised those people.
Right.
No. She delivers everything. Everybody is so happy at her meddling because, you know, she does indeed pay for this wedding, and the wedding comes off, and it's all thanks to her. And she drives this kid to night school, and, you know, everything's all hunky-dory. And I'm like, then what's this movie about?
It's about knowing that you know how to make people happy by helping them a lot. I think I'm going to like this movie.
I found that neither the comedy nor the drama worked because the whole movie is about, isn't it great how she meddles and like fixes everybody's lives for them?
Stop and think for a moment about my interventions in your day-to-day life.
We don't,
and how great they are.
I don't want to talk about this on the show. I mean, I was just trying to imagine, like, if they were turning this into a weekly series along the lines of, like, The Millionaire, where, like, you know, this week the meddler will meddle in your life, you know? And then she has this romance with, you know, J.K. Simmons, who's basically playing We Couldn't Get Sam Elliott.
Really?
Yeah. It just seemed completely pointless. Susan Sarandon's good. She's given it all she's got, and you know she's a charming screen presence. But the movie just didn't have anything to say about, you know, because even if this is about a woman who's sort of not addressing her grief, it's not that interesting in that, because all she does is great stuff for other people, and then eventually she does deal with her grief, and then she still does great stuff for other people, and yay her.
I'll watch it when it hits the TV.
Yeah. It just didn't work for me.
I'm not going to buy a ticket, but I'll eventually check it out, because this sounds like, proof that I'm right.
It's from the writer-director of Seeking a Friend for the End of the World.
Seriously?
Yes.
Maybe I won't watch it ever.
But, you know, Rose Byrne, at least, I think, plays kind of a different character than usual, and she's good in it. And her friends are like Cecily Strong, Casey Wilson, and Lucy Punch.
I like all three of those
people. Yeah, they don't really get much that's very funny to do, but, you know, they're there, at least. They got a paycheck. But so much Grove. So much Grove.
When did they just shoot it all, like, between 5 and 8 a.m. on Sunday mornings or something?
Yeah. By the end of the movie, like, I was kind of hoping that she was going to get hit by the trolley, but which almost happens, but she doesn't. Spoiler.
She meddled with one too many things. She tried to fix the trolley. I went to see The Huntsman, Winter's War.
Right. A.K.A.
Snow White, the Winter Soldier.
Now, is there any Snow White in this movie? Is Kristen Stewart, did she like have a day on the set where she had a something?
I'm going to tell you.
Oh, please. Because I've read reviews. I edited a review of this, and I can't wrap my head around what actually happens in this movie and in what time it's set based on the first movie.
There is not. You will not see a more cynical, money-grubbing sequel, prequel, in 2016.
Worse than Zoolander 2?
A thoroughly pointless... No, Zoolander 2 was a misguided labor of love. This was the classic definition of sequel.
Because the stockholders demanded it.
Yeah. Oh, the first movie made an F-ton of money, and yet no one cared about it? It doesn't matter. We're going to make a sequel. Oh, the star won't come back. Doesn't matter. We're going to make a sequel. I'm about to spoil.
Oh, we killed off a major character played by another star of the film?
Doesn't matter. We're going to make a sequel. I'm going to spoil everything right now, because I don't believe anyone who's listening to this podcast will voluntarily go see this movie.
You don't know.
It begins as a prequel. Years before Snow White, you know. Oh, no, not years before. Just before, I think. Yeah, just before.
Just before the movie, or
just before the Snow White story, where Charlize Theron's sister, played by Emily Blunt, falls in love with a guy, and Charlize Theron, as the queen, the wicked queen, she wants to banish love from the kingdom. But there goes Emily Blunt falling in love with a guy. Until one night, she and the guy, they're going to run away and take the baby that they have made with them. They're going to run away. They're going to live their own lives. They're going to leave the kingdom. But that night, the baby catches on fire.
What? Like in Susan Slade?
Oh, my God. Yes. The baby catches on fire.
The guy
is like executed or whatever. I don't even know what happens to the guy. He gets killed or something. This causes Emily Blunt to turn into Frozen.
Uh-huh.
I'm not kidding. She does everything except sing Let It Go.
Oh, no.
She becomes the Ice Queen.
Right.
All right. Goes to live in her own ice kingdom.
Okay. Does she say the word fractals?
So then, boom, cut to 7 years later. We are now in the kingdom of Snow White.
Okay.
The queen is dead. But the problem is that she's not dead. The mirror is stolen and she's inside the mirror.
Uh-huh.
And the mirror turns to molten gold and she comes back to life.
As you do.
And meanwhile, she's raised all these little huntsmans. One of them is the huntsman, mm-hmm. Thor, and the other one is Jessica Chastain. Mm. They're in love.
I think she's a hunts person.
They're in love. Mm-hmm. And
but that's a no-no.
The Ice Queen throws the wall of ice between them to separate them. Mm-hmm. And in the wall of ice, they see what the queen wants them to see, the Ice Queen wants them to see about the other one. Mm-hmm. So Jessica Chastain sees Thor running away like a coward. Thor sees Jessica Chastain murdered. Neither of these things has happened.
Right.
But they're separated for years. And then...
I forget. Does the huntsman fall in love with Snow White or no?
No. They find each other and they're going to fight the Ice Queen.
I see.
And then also they're going to fight the Gold Queen, the evil Charlize Theron Queen.
Wait, I'm sorry. The huntsman finds Jessica Chastain?
Yeah. Okay. And they band together again and they're, you know...
Okay.
It's war!
Right. It's winter.
Meanwhile, Snow White, you see the back of an actress.
Oh, no.
Freaking out in front of the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. And then someone says, Snow White is unwell. She'll be sitting this one out.
Snow White will not be seen tonight, so we may show you the following program.
Okay, so the war. Now, mind you, here we have Frozen. Little visual signifiers from the Narnia films. Nick Frost and the dude from The Trip. Not Steve Coogan, the other one.
Rob Brydon.
Yeah. As dwarves.
Okay.
And goblins and essentially stuff from Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
Then Emily Blunt comes in riding a polar bear, so we've got Golden Compass stuff happening.
Oh, brother.
There's not one moment of this movie that is not
directly stolen from some other movie.
Oh, jeez.
It is this stew of bits and pieces of other popular films. You know what we need? We need some Frozen. You know what else we need? We need some of that Narnia. You know what else we need? We need some Lord of the Rings stuff in here right now. Everybody just start battling the goblins and the orcs and the polar bears and the and the queen. So the theater's 10% full on Thursday night. Gary Cotty and I are sitting next to each other the entire movie going... Every time Emily Blunt or Charlize Theron's on screen and says anything, one of us says to the other, "Yes, queen." It is so bad. And yet, I did have a good time because I was with a friend and we were taking a giant dump on it. Figuratively speaking.
Maybe we can do this as a club meeting someday.
No. No, we cannot. We cannot and we will not.
I see.
Because the dominant trait of this film is its utter dullness.
Oh.
It's so boring. Mm. Thor's accent is... all over the map. He's American, he's Australian, he's Scottish.
Interesting choice.
Jessica Chastain is a little bit better at this than he is. A total piece of crap. Everything about it. They do solve the problem of who's the fairest of one of all, though.
Oh.
Well, it's Charlize Theron!
Duh.
So nobody's stalking around this film to say, you know, no, it's me. Me, I'm the fairest one of all. Me. This movie, she gets to be, look, I've been the face of Dior for like 10 years. I think we could all agree.
Kristen Stewart is a lot of things, but more attractive than Charlize Theron, that's a tough call.
That is in the eye of the beholder.
Sure.
But let's just state for the record that there is no human being
that's
on
what
Earth
I'm saying.
More beautiful than Charlize Theron.
She's mutant pretty.
I saw Alexander Sokurov's Francophonia.
Right, which I know you're very excited about.
I was very excited about it. If I say that it's the worst Alexander Sokurov film I've ever seen, I am not saying that it's a bad film.
You're just saying it's the least of.
I'm saying that this guy, who is a modern master, one of my favorite filmmakers, has made a film that left me with more questions than anything else. I will explain.
Okay.
This is playing on three screens in Los Angeles right
really?
Now, which is like shocking to me, but it is.
It's one of them IMAX 3D.
If you have not seen Alexander Sokurov's 2001 film, Russian Ark, I urge you to do this. It is a film shot entirely in one take. No tricks.
None of that Birdman crap.
Through the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg. A cast of like 1,000 people. And they rehearsed it and rehearsed it and rehearsed it. And the camera glides smoothly through Russian history in this museum. And people are acting it out and dancing and symphonies are playing and giant ballroom scenes are going on. One take. A monumental achievement. Okay? Now, Sokurov does things in little groups. He does films in pairs. He does films in trios. He, you know, there was a... like a three films about, you know, great... And when I say great, I mean significant.
leaders, because one of them was Hitler.
Father and son.
Father and son, mother and son, both of them magnificent films. So this, in a way, is the minor key companion to Russian Ark. But it has none of the grandeur of Russian Ark. It is formally much more fragmented. And this is him being sort of, you know, having fun might be the wrong way to describe what he does, but this is him sort of fooling around with, the size of the frame. It's big, it's small, it's, you know, letterboxed, it's
square.
Yeah. There's archival footage. It's part documentary, part recreation of historical events. It's about the Louvre Museum, and that's why we would call it something of a companion piece to Russian Ark.
I see.
It's about the Louvre Museum and about a strange yet historically true thing that happened with the Louvre during World War II. Hitler looked to France as sort of a seat of culture in Europe. And while he wanted to own it, he didn't want to destroy it. He did want to destroy the Bolsheviks. Sokurov being Russian, this is, you know, one of his themes in the film. Russia suffered, France quietly surrendered, and they weren't fully destroyed because of it.
Okay.
The leaders of France, you know, they sold out their people. They encouraged everyone, just, you know, give in.
Yeah.
Let it happen.
Vichy.
They did not, however, leave everything in the Louvre. They secreted away all of that stuff in chateaus all around the country. They left pretty much the statues, the sculpture. The Nazis were like, hey, look at all this sculpture we have now. A French culture minister, or culture civil servant, really. He would become a culture minister later in his career. A guy named Jacques Jaujard, real guy.
Yeah.
Winds up having to work with Franz Wolf Metternich, who was one of the Nazis' art conservators. And so a lot of the film is recreation, these two actors sort of sipping coffee and talking about how to preserve art.
Right.
Or they are out in France, like out on the streets. So they are dressed period, their cars are period, but everything around them is contemporary France.
Okay.
Is right now.
Right.
Nothing else is period.
Mm-hmm.
So, theme.
Plus ça change.
The past is always with us. Yeah. Okay, so. The film is about power, which is another recurring theme of Sokurov's, and how art is dependent on power, and how power changes who gets to make art, who gets to see art, who gets to keep art, whose art gets destroyed and obliterated, and whose art gets preserved. And, you know, this is an indictment of humanity, civilization.
Would you say it would be a good double feature with The Monuments Men?
No, because The Monuments Men
was terrible.
Maybe a good double feature with The Train.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
But, you know, this is not a simple movie.
Mm-hmm.
There are other things going on in the film, too. Sokurov narrates it and also appears in the film in present day, Skyping with a man who is on a ship that's carrying art that is hitting rough seas and is about to sink. So, metaphor.
Right.
And also, you are inside the Louvre. He's shot inside the Louvre with two actors, one of whom is playing Napoleon, who walks through the... This is the funny part. He walks through the museum looking at all the paintings and saying, c'est moi. C'est moi. Even if it's not him, he's like, c'est moi. Mine. I brought it here. I took it. It's mine. You've also got the Liberty, Equality, Brotherhood woman. What's her name? Marianne. Is that her name? French Republic symbol.
I think maybe Marianne, the Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité.
Yeah. She's in it, wandering around the Louvre. Mm-hmm. Her parts are the worst because they're pointless. Sokurov is talking to her and she's just like looking like a silent movie person, just big eyes in the camera running mm-hmm. around. I was like, why is this happening?
So,
there were five other people in the theater. There were two disgruntled walkouts. A troubled, not entirely successful Alexander Sokurov movie is better than every other movie playing in your city at this moment.
But if
here's one of the troubles. They talk a lot about the Nazis and everything the Nazis did.
Mm-hmm.
And Sokurov intentionally leaves out the Jews. They are not mentioned in the film. Now, it's an 87-minute film specifically focused on this little tiny element of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
These two guys and what happened to the art and why.
Does he talk about the Holocaust at all or just the art?
No. Hmm. No. Meanwhile, he does talk about, you know, the slaughter of the Bolsheviks.
Hmm.
Like, you see archival footage of a child lying dead and abandoned on some steps at one point. And so, yeah, I finished the movie and I was like, hey, Sokurov.
I think you forgot something.
What about them Jews? Like, weird, it's... And there's no answer. I'd like to hear what he has to say. I mean, he's not anti-Semitic. You know, he's made films about... He makes films about history and about the trouble of history. If there's an overriding theme of his films, it's everything is trouble. So it's fascinating. It's completely watchable. It's... You know, complicated and complex. I'm not sure what to make of it.
Well, and what you told me also is that if you've never seen a Sokurov movie,
it ain't the one to start with.
This is not the one to begin with.
No. Start with Russian Ark or Mother and Son. Mm-hmm. Really. If you can get it. Mother and Son is apparently difficult to find. I think even Father and Son might be difficult to find.
Well, Russian Ark, there was a Blu-ray in the last couple of years, as I recall.
Oh, yeah, there is a Blu-ray of Russian Ark out there, because that's his biggest American film. Anyway. So, I say yes to this movie with the...
A healthy amount of reservations.
With the reservation of, if you are not familiar with this filmmaker's work, don't start with it.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have a DVD pick?
No.
The Blu-ray of Death Becomes Her comes out this week.
Oh, yeah.
A movie that I've always liked.
Mm-hmm.
Has a wonderfully dark sense of humor. It's a very queer film without being gay. in that it is about, you know, two big personality women out to destroy each other. And just little things like the fact that, you know, the opening sequence of the film revolves around a musical version of Tennessee Williams' Sweet Bird of Youth.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's really funny. I think it's one of my favorite Meryl Streep comedies. It's the first movie where Robert Zemeckis really kind of pushed the special effects envelope, I think. I mean, not counting like Back to the Future, but in terms of really changing what we thought... what we realized digital effects could do in a movie and how they could be incorporated in telling a story. And there's a cameo by Sidney Pollack that is hilarious as this ER doctor trying to figure out what's going on. It's very quotable. It's very over the top. Like, it's not a movie I would call campy because it knows exactly what it's doing, but it is, you know, it is an 80s comedy with, you know, two angry women in shoulder pads going at it.
Right.
Streep and Goldie Hawn. I it's a movie I like a lot, so I would recommend people check it out.
Here's what I want to do. We've already been going a little while here.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to make this Sundays or Saturdays, whenever we record it, I'd like to make the next episode sort of in a longer version, and we've been getting... I had no idea what I was getting myself into when I said, hey, everybody, write to us and tell us who you are if you've never interacted with the show before. A lot of letters.
Yeah.
Lots of them. So we need to clear the decks again.
Okay.
With a show and finishing up all these letters.
Okay.
We
don't need to do another separate.
No, we don't. It'll be an extra. This coming week's episode that we'll record on Saturday or Sunday will simply be an extra long episode.
Sure.
Yeah.
And is it... I think actually we may have a guest this week too.
Do we? Who?
I've been talking to John Powers about coming in to talk about his Wong Kar-wai book.
Oh yeah,
and I think he might be joining us.
Okay, well then we will not be going through a million letters with John's visit.
Yeah.
Now this Saturday night is our next Linoleum Knife Club meeting.
Oh wow! Okay.
Isn't it?
I believe. Yeah, because it's the last Saturday in April. Yeah.
And so
we don't know what we're watching.
What movie did we pick?
We haven't picked one yet.
Didn't we?
No.
I could have sworn we did. No,
we picked a movie for our for Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, which we also have to tape this week.
Yes.
But we have not
picked one. No, I think we did.
We haven't announced it, but I don't think we've even picked one.
No, we did. It's in my notes somewhere. We talked about this.
Okay.
Yeah. Well,
we don't at this moment. We don't know what it is, but we'll be posting it on Facebook and stuff. So
I'll go hunt that down. I know we wrote it down somewhere.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
We had this whole long meeting about what we were going to do.
I know, but I didn't think we.
And now I've forgotten what we talked about.
I thought we just like came up with a list of movies.
No, I wrote it down.
All right.
I just have to find the file.
I'm Mr. Organized.
Okay. I do. I have it all. No. You don't understand. I consolidated all my files.
Okay.
They're all in my Word document. They're just not at my fingertips right now because I'm slow.
That you've consolidated them in a Word document is already a problem, but whatever.
Listen, I have... No, not... I don't mean a Word document. A file with my Word document.
Gotcha.
I am technology.
Do we want to read any letters on this episode?
How long have we been going?
An hour 13.
We'll do a few.
Okay.
About this listener, Kira. Hey, Alonzo and Dave. So you say you want to know about the lurking listeners. This is one. Sorry. Well, this one is a lesbian from St. Louis who has only recently started. As a devout Stephanie Miller fan, the Happy Hour podcast with you all hooked me. What reeled me in was the LKTV episode Dave went on about Judy Garland. I have loved her since I was 16. At one point, I accumulated all her movies, and as that was happening in high school, all my friends thought I was a bit strange. 23 years later, it seems that I am. Anyway, I just watched The Clock, a personal favorite of mine. TCM has her as the star of the month. If you weren't aware, I'm aware. They have finally caught up to where I'm at in the chronology mm-hmm. of her films. So it got like four movies this week, this past weekend, mm-hmm. and it's going to get the remainder of them this coming weekend. That just makes me a happy girl. Don't need to read this on the podcast. Well, too late. But I did want to introduce myself and say hello. I should get around to my list. Yes, you should. Unfortunately, I have to get back to homework instead. Thank you, Kira.
Yay.
I like hearing from women.
Yes.
Not that I have a problem with all you guys.
Guys?
But we got a lot of guys who write in.
Yes.
Guys love to write in.
Mm-hmm.
Keep writing in, guys.
Yes, don't stop.
We like guys.
We just want to hear from the ladies as well.
We're homosexuals, so obviously we like guys. But ladies. a York, UK based fan. Hmm. Susanna.
Does that make her Susanna York?
You figure she's probably heard that joke.
Probably.
Yeah. Hey, Alonzo, I'm Dave. Alonzo, Dave, and Dave. I am writing in response to your request to know a bit more about some of your listeners. I've never written into one of the podcast hosts I listened to before, but I think you guys are great. So here goes. My name is Susanna, and I've been listening to Linoleum Knife since the very first episode aired.
A lifer.
I'm sorry. Sorry, Susanna.
You got to witness this in progress.
You've been through us through some rough patches. I originally became familiar with Dave's work when I was in law school and used to read your reviews on the old MSNBC.com site. While avoiding paying attention in class, we were allowed to take notes on our laptops. I spent most of my time instant messaging with classmates and surfing the web. I used to spend a lot of time searching Dave White on MSNBC because I absolutely loved your articles, including the Awful is the New Awesome series, where your description of Basic Instinct 2 and Sharon Stone getting the girls out and Jessica Alba screaming into an oven made me laugh out loud in class.
Forgot about that
I hate you, cake. It also introduced me to The Covenant, which is one of my absolute favorite bad movies. My friend Adam and I still refer to each other as Weatch. I even watched a kung fu movie with a hopping Dracula in it based on one of your articles. Woo! I also became really familiar with Alonzo's movie reviews on MSNBC.com, and I always associate your photo next to the byline strongly with goofing around in mergers and acquisitions. Needless to say, your articles got me through some pretty bleak law school days. After law school, I moved to England and I stopped seeing your reviews. Then completely out of the blue, I found Linoleum Knife on iTunes. I couldn't believe when I saw your names together and realized that not only did two of my favorite movie reviewers know each other, they were married. That's crazy.
I know that you found us individually.
Like, yeah.
Funny.
I cannot describe how excited I was to find your podcast. I've been listening ever since. It has seen me through a post-grad, being unemployed, getting employed, getting married, buying a house, having a baby. My son is now 11 weeks old.
Wow. Congratulations.
I think you both are absolutely fantastic and hilarious and love listening to you guys each week. Your podcast has come in especially handy during my son's naps. It makes me feel like I have adult company during the day. Not to sound incredibly sad or anything. I would offer a list to be knife, but I recognize that my taste in movies is pretty atrocious. Just as an example, I have seen Deep Blue Sea, the one with LL Cool J, about a million times. Well, why not? I haven't seen most Best Picture nominees, let alone winners. My favorite genre is basically the so bad it's good kind. Although I'm not a hipster, just to be clear. Apologies that I haven't yet subscribed. Oh, who cares? I am hoping to do so since I am done with my maternity leave because I thought LKTV was great. However, if you ever find yourselves in England, I would love to buy you both a pint or a lovely cup of tea. I will take the lovely cup of tea. Also the pint, depending on the time of day.
And a sticky toffee pudding, please.
Keep a... Yeah. keep up the awesome work. Sincerely, Susanna.
Thank you, Susanna.
So I just saw an article about all the food at the Wizarding World of Harry Potter.
Oh, yeah, that BuzzFeed piece?
Everything in it is like roast and Yorkshire pudding and sticky toffee pudding and all the best things that England makes.
Yes.
And none of the weird, stupid stuff.
Right, yeah.
That is gross.
There's no kippered herring or kidney pie.
You know, I don't like going to tourist traps, but I will go to the Wizarding World of Harry Potter
after it dies down a bit.
Just for the food.
I totally want to go to the Wizarding World of
Harry Potter. It's never going to die down. We're just going to have to make a reservation and go. We could live here for the next 20 years and it's not going to die down.
Well, I'm not saying there's ever going to be a date where it's going to be completely empty, but I'm just saying I don't want to go in the first 3 months.
Right. And I don't want to go during the summer either because I don't like being hot.
Yeah. I'm thinking like a weekday in early October.
Or late November.
No, because that's already like the holidays.
Whatever.
We'll figure it out.
Maybe they'll do it up for Christmas.
Ooh.
Yeah, see, I knew I'd get you with that.
That's not fair.
Thank you, Susanna. Okay, we're done.
All right, awesome. Well, again, our apologies for being late this week. There will be a new Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife very soon.
This week.
Which, if you are a subscriber, you get it at free. Certain levels, you'll be getting it free. And if not, if you're not a subscriber, but you still want to occasionally pick these things up a la carte, it'll be $1.99. And you can PayPal us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And just let us know which movie you were buying a commentary for and where to send it. I actually put our old commentary tracks in my phone and I've been listening to them, and I have to say,
are we fantastic?
We're really good at this.
Yeah, we're professional film critics.
They're fun to listen to. Check out our friends on the internet. Go to christylemire.com. Listen to the Rotten Tomatoes show with Matt and Gray, the B-Movies podcast with Bibbs and Whitney. They have a new show now called, is it Cancel?
No. Wait.
Oh, man.
I just liked it. Hang on.
And me too. They have a new show devoted to TV shows that were canceled after one season or less.
Hang on, I'm going to get the name. Canceled Too Soon.
That's what I thought. Okay, canceled too soon. So,
episode one, Puchinsky.
Yes. So,
which I've never even heard of.
Go subscribe to that and check out their latest stuff. The B-Movies podcast. Sorry, I said that. The Schmoes Know. The Comics Canon. Sewers of Paris. Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley. The Joel Ryan thing. The Bret Easton Ellis podcast. Fat Guys of the Movies. The Criterion Cast. Film Spotting SVU. The Game Night Guys. And Secretly Timid. You can follow this program on Facebook. Go like our page. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LinoleumCast. Go to iTunes where you can subscribe to the show for free and leave us a review. We do appreciate it. And it does help people find the show. You can stream the show for free at Stitcher Radio or TheLounge.com. And again, our email address is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com, and you can join our club at patreon.com/linoleumknife. Thank you, I Was a Teenage Wereskunk, for your support. That film will be premiering at the Vista Theater in Los Angeles on May 3rd. Again, it's teenagewereskunk.com, W-E-R-E, teenagewereskunk.com. So yeah, until next time, we'll catch you later.
Goodbye.